If you have your Bibles this morning, please turn with me to Genesis chapter 14. Genesis chapter 14, we're going to be continuing our lesson from the life of Abraham from Genesis chapter 14. The title of this lesson this morning is Abram and War in the Valley. As we'll see this morning, Abram was not only a man of peace, but when it was required, he was also willing to fight, to not only defend himself, but also to help out a fellow brother, I believe Lot, who was righteous, as we'll see this morning. But Genesis 14, beginning in verse 1, it says, "And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, and Shador Laomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shem-Eber, king of Zehoiim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. All these were joined together in the vale of Siddim, which is the salt sea. 12 years they served Shador Laomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. And the 14th year came Shador Laomer and the kings that were with him, and smote the Rephaims in Ashtaroth, Carnaim, and the Zuzims in Ham, and the Emims in Shava, Kiriathaim, and the Horites in their Mount Seir, unto El Paran, which is by the wilderness." And it says, "And they returned and came to Enmishpat, which is Kadesh, and smote all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites that dwelt in Hazah and Zor Tamar, and went unto the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah and the king of Admah and the king of Zeboiim and the king of Bela, the same as Zoar. And they joined battle with them in the vale of Siddim, with Shador Laomer, the king of Elam, and with Tidal, king of nations, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, 4 kings with 5. And the vale of Siddim was full of slime pits. The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there, and they that remained fled to the mountain. And they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah, and all their victuals, and went their way. And they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed." This morning, we're going to stop there and get into our lesson. And by the way, I've read that section once. I probably will not try to attempt to read it again. I'm sure I did not pronounce it correctly, but I tried. Anyway, Genesis chapter 14. This morning, we're going to look at Abram and war in the valley. Our first section covers verses 1 through 16. And we're going to see Abram go up against 4 kings, is what we're going to see. And I want you to notice Abram's predicament, and we find it verses 1 through 12. Now, as we begin this, I want to mention that war has been and always will be part of this world until Jesus Christ returns and establishes his kingdom. Some may wonder why. I believe the answer is clear. First, we have a sinful nature. And because of our sinful nature, people are going to be selfish. People are going to act in the flesh. Even after we're saved, we struggle with those things. But people that do not know God, of course, are going to more than likely live according to their flesh. So that's really the first reason. And that leads to the second, which is mankind loves money, possessions, and power. And I don't believe much has changed. People today still love those things. And some will do anything to achieve one or all three. Abram, as we saw last week, and Lot, we're talking about family, separated due to money and possessions, due to the riches they had. And as we'll see this morning, these kings fought over these. They fought over land, and I believe they fought over power or probably even money or substance that could be gained from that land. Today, wars are still being fought for the same reason. I know some wars are fought for other reasons, but primarily men or women want money. They want possessions, or they want some kind of power, and that's the reason why people go to war. You know, as we'll see this morning, war changed the lives of all those involved, and it does so today. You think about that. Anytime there's a war or conflict, it affects many, many people, and we see that happen here as well. Now, as we begin into this, I want you to notice there are 10 kings mentioned in this chapter. Abram's not one of them. 10 kings mentioned in this chapter, and 9 of them were involved in this conflict. And here in a little bit, we'll get to the king that was not involved. But there were 10 kings, 9 were involved in this conflict. And I want to begin first by talking about the coalitions. There were 2. As we've already read in there, like I said, I'm not going to attempt it again. I'm glad I made it through halfway decent once. We have 4 kings. I guess the best way to describe these 4 kings are as invaders. Some may call them oppressors because they did oppress the people there. But these 4 kings, basically we have the king of Shinar, Elasar, Elam, and then we have a king of basically some nations that were united. Just to give you an idea of the location of these countries or these nations, it's believed Shinar was up here. Let me get this correct. It's the Chaldean or Babylonian plain. It's believed it was the southern portion, which would be down this direction, of Nimrod's kingdom. You go back to Genesis chapter 11, you find Nimrod. He established a kingdom. It's believed by this time his kingdom was probably split into two, and that leaves us with the first one down here, Shinar, and then up here in the north in the area of modern-day Syria is, it's believed, Elisar, which would be King Arioch. And then King Shadur-Laomer was king of Elam. We do know that's Persia. And that here is modern-day Iran. You know, what's interesting is the Iranians today, many of them want to change the name. They want to go back to being called Persians. Anytime you read Persia in the Bible, that's Iran, basically, and it's modern-day Iran or the location. So it's believed that that's referring to Persia. Actually, it is, not just believed, but according to the scriptures, that is referring to Persia. Then the final one is has a man by the name of Tidal, and it says there, basically talking about him over nations. It's believed that this was probably just a unified group of nations that had gotten together, or villages, or tribesmen, and he was the king over this group. So you have these four men. And then you have the other five, and it gives them to us, so we'll just look at them real quick. These five were, I guess you could call them the ones that had been oppressed, and in this case, they're going to be the ones who are on the defense. These were, if you look at our, we'll change to a different map here in a minute, but if you look into our map right here, this is the area of Israel. You have the Dead Sea. That's where these five nations were located, either in or around that valley. Here in a minute, we'll pull up a different map so you can see it a little bit better. But we have Sodom, we have Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboiim, Bela, or Zoar. Now, we have an idea where Sodom and Gomorrah were located. Today, when you look at the map of the Dead Sea, it's believed they're probably either underneath where the Dead Sea is today or in that general location. The other three, just based on this passage, it's believed that they were somewhere in that general vicinity, cities or groups that were in the valley or near the valley of Siddim. And it mentions there the valley of Siddim, or the Vale of Siddim is what the Bible calls it. And then it says, which is the Salt Sea. Later it was called the Valley of the Dead Sea, and today we just know it as the Dead Sea or the Dead Sea area. And so that's where all this takes place and where this conflict occurs. I'll change it. Our map. I got the wrong one there. Need the right remote. There we go. Here's our map up here. Gives you an idea of where it's at. This up here is the north. You got the south here. Here's the Dead Sea, Sea of Galilee. You have the Jordan River running in between. This here's a picture. It's kind of difficult to see, but it's a picture of an aerial view of the valley of what it looks like today. Modern day picture of the valley. Basically, that's the valley, as we'll see here in a minute, that they came down, that the invaders came down. And down here in the Dead Sea is the location of where most of the five nations were located. Now let's look at the conflict a little bit. First, notice that the conflict occurred due to a rebellion. Bible tells us that King Shadur-Laomer of Elam was the one who oppressed these people. Evidently, he was the leader as far as these first four nations of this first coalition. Evidently, he was the leader. He was the one in charge. And he had these five nations oppressed, and he went in there and for 12 years, the Bible says, that they were oppressed. Doesn't give us any details, but I imagine that included paying taxes, working, and who knows all that was involved. But evidently, it wasn't, enjoyable, because as we see, they rebelled. Now, the reason why it's believed, a few reasons why this area may have been coveted by some of these big nations, is because of its location. It was located in a central area. Keep in mind, back then they didn't have planes that they could fly over. If they wanted to reach Egypt, or if they from the north, they basically had to go down through this valley or through this region or this area in some manner. And that meant whoever controlled the area or the region probably also controlled the communication and controlled everything, the travel, everything that just went through that area. And so it's believed that it was probably, now keep in mind also, this is before the Dead Sea, as far as we know it, existed. I mean, it was definitely more of a desirable place to live than it is today. But this was probably a location that provided a lot of substance. That's why Lot chose to take that part of the land. So it was probably also, taken or wanted for a practical reason, for substance. That happens today. Nations will conquer pieces of land or for strategic purposes, or even for to gain a substance or to gain more money or things like that. Well, anyway, he oppressed them, it says there, for 12 years. And What I want you to notice next this morning is that the people, the Bible tells us that they rebelled in that 13th year. They didn't enjoy the oppression. They didn't enjoy being controlled and dominated and dictated. So they rebelled in the 13th year. And evidently from the passage, they gained their independence. They were victorious. The Bible tells us that. So that meant they no longer paid tribute. They were no longer under foreign leadership. They had a little bit of freedom, and I imagine they enjoyed it. But the Bible also tells us that it didn't last very long. We have these nations up here, or I could point on the computer, have the nations up here that lost their authority, their control, and their power, and the Bible tells us that they pretty much united, and as we'll see in a minute, they made a charge or a march to take it back, is what they did. Now, one thing I also want to point out is you'll see here, it's mentioned some of the names of these kings. Now, there have been some who have doubted, and if you ever run into this, I just want to clarify this for you, what I believe. There have been some who looked at the scriptures and say, well, there's no way that these big kings would come on down and get involved in this battle and this fight. That just shows you that the Bible is inaccurate or it's not true. Usually, thinking like that is thinking that comes outside of, I guess you say, the time period. What I mean by that is when you approach history, and I believe the Bible is a history of any kind, you have to understand the time period. Yes, today, our president and other leaders will not probably ever see the battlefield. They'll make their decisions from offices, armchairs, watching in front of televisions or computer screens. That's because technology has changed. Even Alexander the Great, even Julius Caesar, Cyrus, Nebuchadnezzar, we know according to history that all those men went to the battlefield. The reason being is because they didn't have the technology that we possess. They couldn't direct from a distance. They had to be there to make decisions, to direct the army. And so I do believe that these kings were probably there. I believe they went there, and I believe, as we'll see, they arrived, and they went there to take this back. They wanted it. And so I do believe this is an accurate history. There's no reason really to doubt what has been said. Anyway, as we get into this, we'll notice this is really the first war that is recorded. It's the first war recorded in history. It's the first war recorded in the Bible. And we'll find it's an interesting battle. So it says in the 14th year that Elam and its allies struck back. I believe they're upset. They're probably mad. They're probably a little bit, I'm trying to think of the word to say, mad, perturbed that these nations would rise up in rebellion and take away their authority. So they made a coalition, and the Bible says that they came marching in. Now we're here in chapter 14 of Genesis, and it says there in verse, let me go back and find it here, in verse 5, it says, in the 14th year came Shador, Laomer, and the kings that were with him and smote, and it gives us a list of nations there that they smote as they came down. So they made their alliance, or confirmed their alliance, put their forces together, and they came marching or sweeping down into the valley. Now you think about this morning. Here's our image up here. They came down into the valley. More than likely, they came up here from the north. They came down, here's the Sea of Galilee, somewhere from this direction. And from all the nations that are mentioned, they basically marched straight down the Jordan Valley, or what's called today the Jordan Rift. We have some groups here mentioned as they swept down, and the Bible makes it seem that they just quickly conquered, or they made light work of these nations. They just took their forces, marched on towards the Dead Sea, down, it's believed, probably over here on the eastern banks of the Jordan River. Now, the people that they conquered are pretty much the original inhabitants of the land, people that probably settled there after the flood and lived there. Now, whether or not they were involved in the rebellion, it appears that they may have either leaned towards, the five kings, probably favored having a little bit of freedom themselves, and so that's probably why they put up a little bit of resistance, and that's why they were quickly overcome and why they were fought. But a few things I want you to notice about these. We have the Rephaims mentioned, the Zuzims, and the Emims. What I want you to think about, a couple of things here. We don't have time to get into this too much, but that word, here's the meanings of those people. The first one, the Rephaims, means the strong ones. The second one, Zuzims, means the powerful ones. And the Emims means the terrible ones. It's believed that these people were the legendary giants that others talked about. You know what's interesting is, could you imagine being one of the five kings sitting and, waiting for the army, and a scout returns and you ask them, how's things going? And they say, well, They've already conquered the terrible ones, the mighty ones, and the powerful ones. I'd be thinking, okay, we better get ready. We're probably in some trouble. This army means business, and they're marching this way. But a few thoughts on this. These groups are associated with the sons of Anak, and in Numbers chapter 13, if you're taking notes, Numbers 13, verse 33, the sons of Anak were considered or were called giants. And so these people were called, I could say, or they were considered to be giants. I don't have time to get into this, but I want to make just a quick reference if you're interested in this study or if it wants to spark any interest in a future study for you. The name Rephaims comes from the Hebrew root Rapha. That same word was used to describe the giants before the flood, those that were wicked, those that were sinful, and the reason why God came down and sent the flood. You know what's also interesting, and like I said this morning, I don't have time to go into it too much, and I don't want to get too far into this. That's the same word. When you go through the Old Testament, later that word is used in reference to evil, dead people that have died, and their spirits that have gone on, their souls. Now, there has to be a connection. I don't know what it is. May not know until God, until we get to heaven. But I do want to say this. The devil was behind a lot of that. David was and Solomon were both ordered to exterminate, to wipe out those groups. And they did. And it was because under God's direction. We know they were idolaters. We know they were wicked. We know they were filthy. There has to be something else. And what I mean by that is evil spirits are real. And I don't have time to go into this, but they are real. There are demon-possessed people. The Bible tells us that in the New Testament. The demons haven't gone anywhere. They're still on our earth today. That's real. Don't mess with things like that. Don't fool around with the occult or evil spirit. Those things are real. They're not just, I guess, say, fiction stories or fairy tales. So we need to be careful with those things and understand that the devil is real and evil spirits are real as well. How much that ties in, I don't know. But it's an interesting thought. If you're interested in that, maybe you can do your own study through that on your own in the Bible. But we're going to move on. Bible tells us that they came down this valley, or they came down the Jordan River. They got to the Dead Sea. That's the area. The Dead Sea, like I said, it probably looked a little bit different than we see it today. As far as the Dead Sea, it probably had less water, of course, more land, more vegetation, and it was set up more for living. Up here is an image of the Dead Sea, pretty much an exact image as if you're standing down here and you're looking north. So you get an idea of the mountains and the hills here to the west of the Dead Sea. According to the Bible, this army came down. They conquered the people that were in their way. And when they got to the Dead Sea, or the Veil of Siddim, is what it's called in the Scriptures, they turned. The Bible tells us they turned eastward. Went down around the Dead Sea, if you look at the nations that it's mentioned and the direction they went, and pretty much went around the Dead Sea, conquered the Amalekites, and I think it's the Amorites down here on the south, and they stopped on this direction. It was a strategic maneuver is what they did. They went down, and as they got to the location where the five kings were encamped and waiting, instead of making a full-on attack, they just went around, pretty much wiped out any assistance or any way of retreat, really. They encircled the five kings is what they did. Hebron and the area or the plain of Mamre is located right here. This is where Abram was residing. Bible tells us when they got there or near Abram, that instead of continuing, now I'm going to tell you this, I believe it was God's grace and God watching out over Abram. Instead of continuing and wiping him out and making a complete circle, what they did is they turned their attention to the five kings and they went on in. And the five kings met them in the Vale of Siddim, and that's where we find the major conflict taking place. And so that pretty much covers this passage here. A few thoughts on this is, like I said, we don't have time to get into all the people or all the names of the nations, but I do believe there's historical records for them, and we find that. And this is an accurate record is what we find. But anyway, the five kings, including the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, went, and they met these invaders out here, and pretty much in the Vale there, or the area of the Dead Sea, and a conflict ensued. You notice the Bible doesn't give us all the details of the battle. I don't think we need all the gory details of the war. We know what war is like, and we know what happens when people fight against each other and they go to war. And so what we are told, though, from the passage, it appears as if it was I don't want to say easy, but really a rather quick victory. I mean, there really didn't seem to be a whole lot of resistance. As we see, we go to Genesis chapter 14. It says there, verse 10, and the Vale of Siddim was full of slime pits. Kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there, and they that remained fled to the mountain, took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals and went their way. So they made this charge in here. The Bible says that they defeated them. And they just fled. And they fell into the slime pits, and they, which is where we get some of our asphalt today, and even in that area. And some believe maybe that was what they were, the reason why they wanted to control that area, because of all the substance and maybe from the slime pits. Anyway, their survivors fled. They ran. There were probably a lot who did not live through this battle, who died through this. And the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities were defeated. And the Bible tells us those cities were plundered. Not only were they defeated, but they were plundered. They went in there and they took the goods, and they even took the people, and they took them captive, and they left. These cities, when you think about it, had riches, and that's the reason why Lot turned towards these cities. But those riches were gone. I mean, it's easy when you think about it, the things of the world will not last. I mean, we know we're not going to take them to heaven with us, but we also know it's easy to lose things like that in this world. So there's nothing wrong with having them. If God has blessed you with possessions or riches of any kinds, be thankful. But remember who has blessed you with those, and put your trust in God is what the Bible teaches in Timothy. What we find next is kind of interesting. It says there, verse 12, and they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. They took Lot with them. So we have, of course, the coalitions. We have the conflict that took place. Now I want to talk real quick about the captive. One captive I want to focus on, and that's Lot, because that's what the Bible focuses on. One captive that they took was Lot. Lot, either at this point, now keep him, last chapter we saw him choosing the land. Bible says he pitched his tent towards the land. Evidently, he moved a little bit closer. Whether he lived in the cities or at least close enough, he lived close enough to be associated with them and to be involved in this. Later, we're going to see that Lot actually becomes, it's believed, a leader in Sodom. But at this point, he lived close enough to be taken, and Lot lost his goods. You know, he lost those things that he loved, what separated him from Abram to begin with. And he lost them. Remember, he chose the land near the cities because he desired it, because of the way it appeared and the way it looked, and probably because it had helped his substance. And he lost those as well. He lost everything and was taken. You know, I'll give you a question before we move on. What good are the things of this world when you're about ready to depart this world? Now, I know Lot didn't lose his life at this point, but I'm sure during the battle it probably crossed his mind. And when he was taken captive, he didn't know what his future held. You know, when you begin to think about it, the things that are eternal are what really matter. And that's what the lesson we can learn from Lot. Also, the second lesson we can learn from Lot is, he may have been righteous. I believe he was. We find that, we'll talk about that more in a few weeks when we talk about the cities, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. I believe he was a righteous man. But he lived near the world and partook in the things of the world. And so when the world suffered, do you realize he suffered as well? Abram separated himself. God protected him. Lot chose to live in the world. You know, we just need to be careful of whom we associate with. We need to be careful of how we live and where we go and what we do. Even as adults, you know, we teach our children that. We say, be careful who you associate with. But as adults, we need to do the same thing. Lot lost his freedom. He lost his independence. He was taken captive. Also, Lot shared in the difficulties of the world. You know, if we're going to choose to live in the world, we shouldn't be surprised if we partake in the hardships that come with living in the world. Now, Lot should have separated himself like Abram did. He may have had some land nearby, but he should have lived separately and separated himself like Abram. But he chose not to. And he went towards, and chose to live in that area near Sodom, and he ended up paying the price. Now we're going to look at the next passage or next section for us here this morning, and that begins in verse 13. Genesis chapter 14, verse 13 says, "And there came one that had escaped," he says there, "and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, and brother of Anir, and these were confederate with Abram. And when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. And he divided himself against them, he and his servants, by night, smote them and pursued them unto Hobah, which on the left hand of Damascus, brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his goods, and the women also," he says, "and the people." So we're going to look at this section real quick. We're going to look at Abram's pursuit of these four kings. Now, before I move on, this is our last map, so I just want to show you real quick before we move on to know where things are taking place. Abram probably dwelt in this area here, the plain of Mamre down here in Hebron, this general direction. Here's the Dead Sea. It's believed afterwards that they conquered the cities. They probably put them under some kind of authority after they plundered them. The army took off north up this direction. It says he followed him up to Dan. That means he pursued him up to this direction. And he followed him all the way up to near Damascus, which was way up here. Abram pursued these people a long distance. It wasn't just, you know, going out, I don't know, 100 yards or so, or 200 yards. He went a long ways to make the pursuit. It's believed that it probably, you know, took a little bit of time, too, to go after them and then to make the rescue. But as we get into this, I want you to notice a few things concerning Abram. Till I get that fixed, I keep hitting the wrong controller. There we go. As far as Abram is concerned, we're going to look at a few things at this pursuit. Notice first, he received the report. This man escaped. Who he was, the Bible does not tell us. Evidently, he was either a prisoner of war or he was a resident of Sodom that was taken. Either way, this man found Abram and provided all the information concerning this battle and what had taken place and told him all that had happened. And the Bible tells us that Abram listened. He heard him out. And then if you'll notice, Abram responded, I believe, when he heard that Lot was involved. You see, Abram's listening carefully. I could just see him sitting down and this man sitting down telling him and retelling him everything that's happened. And then this man mentions Lot. And all of a sudden, I could see Abram, what? You said Lot? What happened to Lot? And then the Bible tells us that Abram responded. You see, Abram loved Lot. And I believe Abram, as we'll see here in a minute, was willing to do anything to help him out. Anything to assist him. Abram, Bible tells us, pursued the enemy. You know what I think is interesting? He didn't excuse himself from this. He could have said, oh, that's Lot's problem. He chose that land. He wanted to live by the cities. He's tough break, but he's going to have to deal with it. So he didn't excuse himself from this situation. Also, he didn't ignore it. He didn't say, well, I'll just pretend it didn't happen. He didn't isolate himself from the problem either. He separated from the world, but when the problems occurred, he dealt with them if he had to. You see, I think a few thoughts here, as we'll see in a minute. I believe he loved Lot and he wanted to rescue him. But he also understood that his possessions and everything he had also made him vulnerable to attack from these kings as well. You see, Abram was willing to forget the problems, forget the strife concerning their herdsmen. And he was willing to go and help Lot out. He was not upset. He was not bitter. He was not vindictive. He was not vengeful. But actually, he was merciful. He was willing to give up his own life and risk his life to help out someone that he cared for. The Bible tells us that he took decisive military action. Think about that for a minute. A lot of times today, in our world today, we go to the Bible and everyone wants to talk about the love and the friendliness and all. And it's there. But if you go to the Bible, you also find a lot of tough men who took a stand when it was needed. Abram took a military stand or a militaristic stand in this situation. But as we get into this, notice it was not to enlarge his possessions. He didn't do this to go conquer land or to oppress people. He did it to aid and rescue a friend, a relative, his nephew. I think it was the noble thing to do. It's correct. He did the correct thing, and we find nowhere where he was reprimanded. The Bible does not reprimand him for this decision. God does not tell him he was incorrect. I believe he did the correct thing. You know, when you think about Abram, he was a man of peace. He was. He made peace with Lot. He lived in peace there in the valley. But you know what also we find? He defended himself, and he was ready to help or ready to fight when it was required. And I believe probably because he knew he lived in a world of sin. He knew that there were people out there that did not, I guess, they want to live in peace. And so he prepared himself. The Bible says that he had 318 trained men. These men were ready to go, in other words. That's what we find. He doesn't have to go out and find some men and get them ready. Abram was already ready to go. He had 318 men trained, and they were men that were evidently trained for war or trained to fight. Perhaps he divided his servants, because we know that there's no way he took all of his servants with him. I'm sure he had to leave some for defense, and he had to leave some to continue to, not only defend, but also to the livelihood of everyone else who remained, the women and the children. So he had to have had more servants. These were probably the ones that were trained to fight, the ones who would provide the defense and attack if necessary. And so Abram had these servants, and they went out looking or pursuing the enemy. You see, Abram was wisely prepared. And here's what we can learn from this. I don't think any of us has an army at our disposal. So we're not preparing ourselves for war. But you know, we need to prepare ourselves for many other things. The Bible teaches preparation. I really do believe that we should prepare ourselves if we're able. Now, there are a lot of things in the future we know nothing of or out of our control. And God understands that. But you know, there's nothing wrong with saving money. There's nothing wrong with having a savings account and preparing for the future in case you need it. either whether it's an emergency or for retirement. There's nothing wrong with that. I believe we should prepare. Spiritually, we should also prepare. You know, we should pray, we should read our Bible before trials come into our life. You know, when a trial comes into your life, it's better to already be prepared, walking with God, ready to go take something to Him, than it is to, oh no, I better start praying, I better seek God out. So begin praying now before there's a trial. Prepare yourself and walk with God. Anyway, we find that he pursued the enemy. Really, it's a relentless pursuit. Now, I believe when you read this passage, not only his pursuit, but his tactics, as we read here in a minute, or we've already read, were really equal to any general that's ever taken the battlefield. Abram was a very, not only an intelligent man, but he was very decisive as far as his leadership. Bible says he made an attack at night. He split his forces, attacked at night, defeated the enemy. It was a very tactical decision is what it was. And they were surprised. They fled. They probably weren't expecting a well-trained force riding up behind him. I imagine they thought it was over. They had taken care of everyone there that was a problem, and they were just going to move on. And they didn't expect this. You know, when you don't expect something is when you can get yourself into trouble. And so that's what happened here. And he pursued them all the way up, it says there, near Damascus. And eventually he recaptured or took Lot back and everyone else and all the goods. You know, what we have here is a man who was willing to help out and willing to put himself at risk. Now, before we move on, there are some, you may even read them yourself or hear them, there are some who say, oh, this is a fiction story, it didn't occur. We don't find it in any other historical record, we just find it in the scriptures. I'll just share this with you. Many ancient kings, actually most, refused to record their defeats or their losses. Many of them just recorded their victories. You know, if you read the accounts of some ancient kingdoms, the Babylonians, some of their kings, and the Persians, you would wonder where they're at today, because they never lost anything. You read an account, they're undefeated, yet they're not here. So basically what you find in history, you'll find a lot of these kings didn't record their defeats. They didn't record what they lost. And by the way, these five nations are also non-existent as far as today. Now, Persia's still there, the land's still there, but a lot of their records were wiped out and gone years ago. So just because something doesn't show up in history doesn't mean that didn't happen or did not exist. I tell you, 99.9999, the list goes on, percent of people that have ever lived are not recorded in history. Doesn't mean they never lived. It just means nobody recorded or put their name down so people can read about them. So just because it's not there, don't let that discourage you. The Bible has it recorded, and the Bible is an accurate history. So we find this account. Now, we have a few minutes, and I want to get into this last section real quick. We have Abram coming back from the battle. He's victorious. And we find him meeting two kings. Remember at the beginning of this, I said that this chapter has 10 kings, and 9 of them were in battle. One king is not mentioned in the fight, and that's the one he runs into first. Genesis 14, verse 17, and the king of Sodom went out, or actually runs into him second. It says, king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Shador, Laomer, and of the kings that were with him at the valley of Shavah, which is the king's date. Now notice verse 18. We're going to come back to the king of Sodom here in a minute, but verse 18 says, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God, and he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And he gave him tithes of all. Now we're going to stop there, because afterwards he goes to the king of Sodom. But we have two kings coming out to meet him. We have the king of Sodom first, he's introduced first, and then we have the king of Salem. And evidently, Abram paid more attention to the king of Salem than he did the king of Sodom, because even though the king of Sodom is introduced first, we have the account of what took place between the king of Salem and Abram, and then the king of Sodom steps in. Anyway, the king of Salem, his name is Melchizedek. It means king of righteousness. This man is a mystery. You realize his presence produces more questions than answers, and I'm going to give you some of them. Who was he? Where did he come from? We know he's the king of Salem, but where did he come from originally? Why did Abram be called in the land if there was already a king who was there? See, that's another question. Why did he have divine authority to be a priest? You see, those are a lot of questions that we have here. And I want to tell you this, those questions remain unanswered. We have the account of Abram returning victorious, meeting this king of Salem. And this king of Salem, the Bible tells us the first thing we see here is that he brings out bread and wine, and he provides some refreshment for Abram's men. Now, if you'll notice, those are the same two elements that are involved in the Lord's Supper. the bread and the wine. Nothing else is said here of that, but I can't help but think that they are a little bit of a symbolism referring to the coming Redeemer and also the Lord's Supper later to come. But what we find is Melchizedek blessed God on Abram's behalf. That's the act of a priest. He blessed him on Abram's behalf. A few things he mentions there. He calls him, if you notice, we've read it. Let me go back and find it there. He says, verse 19, he said, "Blessed be Abram," he says, "of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth." Notice a few things as far as his reference of God. He recognizes God as being sovereign, God as being in control of all things. And then he also reminds Abram that the reason why he was victorious was because of God, the possessor of all things. It was a reminder to Abram that God was great, is what we find here. And then we find Abram paying tithes to Melchizedek. Now, the tithe just means the tenth, or a tenth. Apparently, Abram paid tithes, I believe, from the passage. He paid tithes of all that he had. He paid a tenth to Melchizedek. Now, this was before the law. Melchizedek accepted this tithe, and Abram tithed on all that he had. You know, Abram understood that his blessing came from God, and so he was willing to give back. We don't have time to get into this too much, but I want to just talk about one thing, the identity of this man. Everyone, his identity is debated. What I mean by that, there are a lot of people who try to say, well, this it was him. I'll just give you the two most common, or the three. The first one is Shem. People say, well, Shem. Shem was Noah's son. And we do know, according to scriptures, if the genealogy is lined up the way the Bible says, that Shem was still alive at this time. He was nearing death, but he was still alive. And some say, well, it was Shem. Here's the question that comes from that is, why did he change his name? Why didn't he say Shem? Why was it Melchizedek? And some say, well, it was a title. Well, why didn't the Bible explain it? So that's what arises from that. The second one is, they say, well, it was Jesus Christ manifested in the flesh. And, you know, I do believe Jesus Christ did, in the Old Testament, show himself to different men and talked with them at times. But with this, Jesus Christ, of course, fits some of the description here. But later in the book of Hebrews, the Apostle Paul uses Melchizedek to say this is a type of Christ. I guess it's kind of redundant to use Jesus Christ as a type of himself. If it was Jesus, it would just be Jesus. You know, a lot of people also believe it was just a king. Just a king that loved God, like Abram, was called and chosen for a purpose and for a reason. Here, I'll just finish with this. Ready? I don't have the answer to this. I don't know the answer to this. But I will tell you this. He is recorded exactly how the Spirit wanted him recorded. And the reason being, later in the book of Hebrews, when it talks about a type of Christ, it says that Melchizedek was without lineage. He was a priest and a king. You know, you don't find that in the Old Testament anywhere else. You find priests, but they're never kings. And you find kings, but they're not priests. That's what got Saul in trouble. He acted like a priest, but he was actually a king. Here is the man we find that was a priest and a king. And Jesus Christ is both priest and king. And you know what it is, basically, more than anything else? This was set in place, I believe, thousands of years before, by God, so that way later it could be used to show us that Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. Now, we don't have time to get into that. I hope I didn't confuse you more on that than anything else. We may study that more in the future, but this is just a quick lesson. But anyway, what we find here, this man, Melchizedek, encouraged Abram. Abram went back, or Abram continued on, after this encouragement. Real quick next, notice the temptation now. We're going to close with this. Verses 21 through 24 says there, "And the king of Sodom said unto Abram, Give me the persons and take the goods to thyself. Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abram rich, save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their portion." Here we have Abram tempted with riches. I'm going to give you a few thoughts. We're going to close with a word of prayer. Abram tempted with riches. Here comes the king of Sodom. Now, first, I'm going to tell you, this was audacious of him. Very, very arrogant. Abram had went and conquered this nation that had pretty much overran that king and his cities. When you think about it, Abram had the right, when he came back, to give back what he wanted to give back. Really, it was his decision. This king came out arrogantly and attempting to make a deal with Abram. But notice something real quick about this king. Notice what he wanted. He didn't want the goods. At first, it appears that it was a good deal. Oh, it was, you know, he was very generous. He was going to give Abram the money. But I want you to notice something about him first. He didn't want the goods. Abram could have those. You know what he wanted? He wanted the souls. That's what he wanted. I believe he wanted his servants. He wanted his people. He was no different than those kings that had come down to oppress all of them. He just was on a smaller scale. He just wanted to continue to oppress his people, his servants. You know, when you think about it, that's how the devil works today. You know, the devil's after souls. We talk about winning souls and reaching people for Christ. You know, the devil is active today, and his desire is to keep people from Christ. He's after souls. I guarantee you, he's after the souls of your children. He's after the souls of your grandchildren, of your friends, of your family. He's after those souls. He wants to keep them from Christ. He would love to keep them in darkness and keep them from coming to God. And I'm going to tell you this, the devil, I believe, will give people or allow or tempt people with riches in exchange for that. And you think about this, how many parents have made this trade? How many parents have gotten to the point where their career and money is more important than their children? They see their children, what, maybe an hour a day when they get home real quick and they hurry up. They've lost sight of what real value is. Now, I know we have to work and I know we have to have careers, but you know what? Our children, if you have children, are important. Your grandchildren are important. Spend time with them. Teach them after God. You know, churches have also taken this deal. You know, a lot of churches have decided to live for earthly treasures, trying to pack a house and build brand new buildings and have all these neat gadgets. And so because of that, they have turned to entertainment and forsaken souls. Now, they have people, but they're not reaching them for Christ. They have forsaken, and they no longer preach the gospel. They no longer challenge people to get right with God. And they have taken this deal, and they're living for the treasures. Now, Abram here, and I want to close with this, Abram refused this offer. And someone said, well, why'd he do that? First, he made it clear that he did not want anything that was associated with Sodom. He didn't want anything associated with this king or this wicked city. And he made it clear, he put his hand up and made an oath to God. Some believe he may have made a vow before. The Bible doesn't tell us this. Either way, we do know that he wanted to give God the glory, God the credit, and God the honor. You see, Abram didn't want to be considered a hireling. He didn't want people to go and say, well, he just went after those people because of money. He knew that if he got them, he'd have all those goods and those treasures. He wanted his testimony to be clear, and he wanted people to know that God blessed him. You know, in closing this morning, you think of Abram. Abram had the opportunity, and that's what I want to close with at this passage. He had the opportunity to establish his kingdom on earth. He did. He could have kept those people. He could have kept all those goods and all the money. And he could have said, nope, I'm going to establish my kingdom. And he could have began to do his best to begin to lay the groundwork there and establish his kingdom right there with himself as king. But that was not what God wanted him to do. And later in the book of Hebrews, it talks about Abram looking for a land, a heavenly country. You see, the reason he didn't establish his kingdom is because he wasn't interested in the things of the world. He was looking for God's will and God's direction, and he was looking for the future with God. You know, this morning, I want to encourage you as we close, with one final thought. Just keep your eyes on God. You think of Abram. God blessed him in the midst of turmoil because he was where he was supposed to be, out in the plain of Mamre, not living in near the cities of sin. And then secondly, God gave him the strength to help another brother, a righteous brother in Christ, or a righteous brother in the Lord, and he gave him the strength to do this because Abram was not acting in a selfish manner. I believe he sincerely wanted to go and rescue Lot and to help out everyone else that had been taken. And then thirdly, Abram at the end gave God the glory, God the credit, and he continued to look to God. Now next week, it'd be wonderful if we could look and say, you know, Abram, the rest of his life was like this. But how many of you know that right after a victory is when the devil's going to come in with the greatest temptations, and you're going to, the struggles will still continue.